I remember one of my very last homiletics courses, one of my very last classes with my homily professor, and he was handing out the evaluation forms. It was a theology level seminary, so we're taking our evaluation forms and evaluating the class. And he said to us, "Do you have any questions while you fill that out?" And one of the students raised his hand. He said, "No, I do have one question." He said, "What have you found to be the most effective words to grab people's attention? You know, if you really want to grab a hold of their attention, you know, what can I say to really get them started?" And he said, "Well, in all my experience, you know, you can tell a joke and people listen for a few minutes after the joke, or you can do any number of things, and depending on the crowd, you might get different responses." He said, "But when you're going in cold, if you really, really want to grab their attention, there are two words you start whatever you need to say with, and if you can start with those two words, or those three words, then you'll get them every time." And we all kind of paused because we were trying to think what two or three words we could say that would immediately grab everyone's attention. And he smiled at us and he said, "It goes like this. If you want their attention, just say, 'And in conclusion,'" and then suddenly everyone sort of perks up and, you know, they're suddenly aware of what's going on and they grab it from there. It is a strange way to start a homily, but I found it always be very interesting to sort of jump to the end and then look at the beginning. It is the first Sunday of Lent. We're starting this beautiful season, this holy season, where we really come face to face with our struggle towards God. And I think it's a worthwhile consideration when we begin the season of Lent that we actually stop and consider that at the very beginning. Where did we come from? And how did we get here? I don't literally mean here right this second, but in the grander scheme of things, where did we come from and how are we in our situation? Well, if we trace our history back, and I don't actually mean trying to find an exact historical timeline, because then we can talk about genetics and locations and things, but if we jump all the way back, we find ourselves trying to express a simple reality of our relationship with God. And so we have Genesis, and I love Genesis. I think that Genesis can express one of the most incredible things about our lives and such beautiful and simple terms. And yet Genesis seems to be one of the hotly debated books. There seems to be plenty of fighting over Genesis. There's this great criticism. Well, you know, it didn't happen exactly that way. It took, you know, millions and billions of years to form the earth and form the stars and do all those things. And I always have to come back with the same question every single time. Where in Genesis does it say this is a science textbook that should be treated as such? No one can point to where it says that, so I always kind of have to point out the fact that, remember very simply, that Genesis expresses a reality to us of our relationship with God. It does not claim that this is exactly how it happened in a scientific expression of time and space and reality, and nowhere does it state that this absolutely has to be the way it happened in time, space, and reality. What it expresses is our relationship with God. And consider for a moment that when we look at this garden in Eden, first of all, it says that the garden is where the Tigris and the Euphrates meet. If you pull out any map, the Tigris and Euphrates don't meet. It's not a physical location in that sense. Even they knew that when they wrote it down, because the Tigris and Euphrates don't come together. But they express this place because it is an opportunity to express a reality with God, not a location. Because the garden isn't necessarily one place on earth. Quite the contrary, the Garden of Eden, this place in the east where God set up a garden, think of it more like your life. The garden is potentially what our life can be. Fruitful and green and vibrant. And at the center of the garden is the tree of life. At the center of our life should be that life. And at the very center, at the very heart of what the garden is a simple, simple statement. God said, "Eat the fruit of any of the trees in the garden. Enjoy your life. Express it in so many ways. But at the very heart of who you are, at the very heart of the tree of good and evil, I want you to not eat that fruit. It's not because the fruit is destructive. It's not because it's poisonous. It's not because it's explosive. It's not like they're little hand grenades you could pull off and throw them. It's not because they are immediately caustic or acidic or somehow destructive. It's a simple request from God. It said, would you always keep that in mind, that I want you to show your love for me? And at the very heart of who we are, at the center of our lives, should be God. What if we looked at the garden in those terms, as a place for our life with God at the center, and at the very center of who we are is that simple request, will you show your love for me by doing these things that I ask? They don't always have to make perfect sense. It doesn't always have to follow that we don't touch the stove because it's hot. But just a simple response that said, I will do these things because I show my love for God. You know, we're asked not to eat meat on Fridays in Lent and offer particular sacrifices in the Friday throughout the year. Does eating meat kill us? I mean, contrary to any particular one study that might try and point to the benefits or the advantages or the disadvantages of eating meat, it is a part of our diets, and it is not immediately poisonous. You don't see people running around eating meat and then keeling over and dying. But it is that simple expression that says, I want to show my love for God. And that's what we have in this garden. That's what we have in this. And what do we encounter? Well, we encounter the serpent. Notice it doesn't say where the serpent came from. It doesn't say how long they've been in the garden when the serpent came along. It happens. It's not a specific timeline. And we come and we engage with temptation. And what does temptation ask us? It says, is this really the way we're going to show our love for God? I mean, it's just fruit, and it's so tasty, and it's this wonderful opportunity to become more like God. What if instead of having God in the center of your life, what if we displace God? What if we put it whatever we want? Because then we get to become God. Then we know what's good and evil. We become the center of our lives. And it becomes confusing because at first it's one of those roundabout arguments. But well, it's not so much the fruit, but what God asked of us. And he said, don't touch it lest we die. Well, certainly, like, well, you won't die. It won't be that bad. Whatever that thing that we're struggling with, it won't be that bad. It's easier than that. It won't be as bad. No. What does it say? It says, you will know what is good and what is evil. And what happens? Well, the woman eats it. So now we can blame the woman. Except in the next sentence it says, and she gave it to her husband who was with her. And we're right back to blaming the man. It's a shared sin. We can't actually pin it on any one person. We pin it on Adam, but we can't pin it necessarily on anyone. It's the fallen of humanity. We give in to temptation. And we displace God, and we put in our own desires at the center of our life. And what happens? Well, immediately their eyes are opened. What is the first thing they see? Remember, the serpent promised them that they'll know good and evil. That's actually what he said. And he was right on. He didn't lie to them. He said, you'll know what's good and evil. And that's true. The very first thing they do is their eyes are opened, and they see that they've committed the evil act. And they're the ones who have committed the evil act. And what happens? Their eyes are open, and they realize that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made loincloths for themselves. Why? Because they were naked. Weren't they naked 20 seconds prior? Of course they were. Apparently they weren't worried about fig leaves then. The challenge was, his shame entered in, and they had something to be ashamed of, and they tried to cover their shame. See, it's not just about an absence of clothing when they express that they're naked. It expresses the simple reality of having something to hide or having something to try and cover up. And before that moment, before they displaced God in their life, they really didn't have anything to be ashamed of. They really just embraced the simple reality of who they were, and they had no shame because they had nothing to be ashamed of. But once we displace God, once we sort of push that out in our life and try and put our own things in, once we try and fill that need for God with our own stuff, well, then we do have shame, and we do have a need to cover things up. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating for a nudist society of any kind. I'm quite happy with my clothing, and I don't actually want to change that. What I'm talking more about is the analogy of what it is, the analogy of this need for us
to put God back in the center of our life. And I love this because we pair this with Matthew. We come to Matthew and Jesus goes out into the desert, led by the Spirit, and he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. And guess what? He was hungry. I'm glad it wasn't a government study. We could have spent millions of dollars to discover the same thing. But it turns out if you don't eat for 40 days and 40 nights, you get hungry. It happens. I know, it's amazing. And there in his weakness, there in his isolation, and there in the desert, he encounters that same serpent. And I find this absolutely important for us because the first man encounters God and sees what his life can be. The garden can be green and lush and fruitful because God is in the center of our life. And that's what it can be. It can be this beautiful thing. But we've pushed it out. We've pushed God out from the center of our life. And what happens is that green, lush garden becomes a desert. And we go without. And we lack. And we become hungry. It's not physical hunger, so it's harder to express. But we become hungry. And the man goes out and he's isolated. And what happens? He's tempted with the most basic of things. If you're really the Son of God, if you are who you say you are, if you are this great capable one, take these rocks, make them bread, and your life is better. You fill the void. You're hungry, make bread, you can eat. It's all better. And the response is, it's more complicated than that. Man doesn't live on bread alone. I hear that quote and I think, well, of course we don't live on bread alone. There's meat and cheese and pickles to put on that bread. There's lots of things we want to add to that bread. I mean, come on, they're delicious. But it's not just the bread. It's whatever stuff we use to fill our life. It's whatever we're consuming. Whatever volume of consumption that we have, we don't live on just that stuff. The material gain, those things in our life that we consume constantly. That's not what we live on. It's part of it. It feeds a part of us. But it's not everything. It can't feed all of us. Instead, we need the words that come forth from the mouth of God. That's where we get fed. And it goes into further temptation. Throw yourself on the side of the temple. You cast out in this desert, throw yourself on the side of the temple. God will protect you. It's promised in Scripture. Remember, even the devil knows Scripture. He knows it very well. It's promised in Scripture. He says, no. No, with God at the center of my life, I don't need to test it. He's there. And finally, the great temptation. He says, look at everything you could have. Look at all the stuff that I could fill your life with. Whatever that is. Whatever thing you really, really feel that you desire. Whatever those things are. I can fill all of it. All you have to do is place your concerns here and now at the immediacy. Fill me with stuff. And God says, no. He says, no, God alone you worship. We have to have God at the center of who we are. We have to have God at the center of everything that we're trying to do. And with that, the devil pulls back. Just for a time. He'll be back. Temptation's always around the corner. There's always something new to struggle with. But for us, as we begin the season of Lent, as we begin the season of fasting, and remember the three great challenges of Lent, fasting, prayer, and almsgiving. And remember that fasting, that's not just food, it's not just what we eat. It's anything that we take in. We can fast from lots of things. Screens, media, food, unnecessary wasting of any kind of frivolity. That fasting that pulls away from the stuff that we don't really need in our life. Stuff we could live without, we enjoy it. It's not necessarily bad in itself. But we can fast from it. And by doing so, it gives us that opportunity to place God back in the center. That simple response of, I want to love God. And you might be amazed at how lush that garden can be. So I want to challenge you as we begin this season of Lent to really embrace fasting, not just as some sort of punishment, not just as some sort of isolation, but a return to Eden. A return to Eden in that true metaphorical sense, where Eden is our life. And with God at the center, it can be very fruitful.